When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
On Saturday, October 28th, 2023, Matthew Perry drowned in the hot tub of his Los Angeles area home.
Tina Turner, the iconic queen of rock and roll, passed away after a long illness at the age of 83.
On September 1st, 2023, Jimmy Buffett, the iconic American singer, songwriter, business tycoon, and philanthropist, died from complications from Merkel cell carcinoma.
Sinead O'Connor died at the age of 56. Talented, polarizing, complicated, and uncompromising until the end.
On July 30th, 2023, Paul Rubens, known the world over for his creation and portrayal of the iconic Pee-wee Herman, died after a six-year battle with cancer.
Welcome to the Last Days podcast. I'm Derek Kaufman here with Jason Beckerman. And Jason, this is our year-end episode where we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest episodes of 2023. You know, Jason and I wanted to take this opportunity to reflect on the past 9 months of this journey and starting this podcast and thank everyone for coming along with us. It's been very gratifying to see how this podcast has been picked up. And we wanted to recap where we are now here at the end of the year. And I thought no better way to start this podcast than kicking it off with what was the biggest news story in our field of the year.
Yeah, any discussion of the biggest deaths of 2023 begins and ends with Matthew Perry. Obviously, Matthew Perry obtained great fame playing Chandler Bing on 10 seasons of Friends. He was not only famous, but became a beloved character on the show, and he personally became a beloved actor. His trials and tribulations that happened later in his life are well documented. Chronic drug use, his later public appearances, including the much ballyhooed Friends reunion a couple of years ago on HBO Max, really showcased how much trouble he was in, the difficulty he had speaking, the way that he looked. Everybody knew that he had really suffered ever since Friends went off the air.
But despite all of that, the shock of his passing and the way that it went down with him found in his hot tub face down, although we had known he was a troubled figure, we knew he had issues with drugs and substances. He was very open about this. He wrote about it in his memoir. Nevertheless, to be taken at the age of 54 years old on the heels of this Friends reunion, all of these warm feelings about, you know, looking at his career and him actually seeming to have some of his life under control. You know, he had been sober for a number of months prior to his passing. And the day he passed, he played a full round of pickleball. So this was a guy who was trying to battle these demons and seemed to be winning in some ways before this tragedy struck.
So in mid-December, the coroner for LA County issued the report that he had died from the acute effects of ketamine. He had been undergoing these therapeutic ketamine treatments to treat his anxiety and depression for a long time. Apparently, he had his last infusion therapy about a week and a half before he died. But nevertheless, despite the fact that that therapy would no longer have been in his system at the time he died, the coroner found that there was a tremendous amount of ketamine in his system, leading to the inescapable conclusion that he had been self-medicating even outside of the doctor's purview, and that's ultimately what killed him.
I think that's right. We're going to see a conversation about ketamine, I'm sure, in the aftermath of his death. You know, it's a recreational drug that also has these therapeutic effects. Obviously, Matthew Perry got himself into some trouble after he used it for therapeutic reasons, possibly just recreationally. He was taking some ketamine. People do that, and it was just one dosage too much, and he passed away. But this story for us was massive, and rightfully so. This is exactly sort of the type of story that would gain this much traction. You saw all of the Friends came out. They gave these sort of somber, reflective sort of statements about Matthew Perry, and I think his death will still sort of resonate for a while.
That's right.
I wanted to move on to, you know, this was a big, big year, but in my mind, the death that sort of saddened me maybe the most was the death of Tina Turner. Tina Turner is an absolute icon. In May of this year, she passed away from a long undisclosed illness. She passed away in Zurich, Switzerland. You know, she had a stroke in recent years. It's unclear exactly what caused her passing at the end of her life. But this truly was a groundbreaking death in this podcast and just sort of around the world. You know, she was the queen of rock and roll, and she was so well known to different generations. I think to Harvey, Tina Turner meant something when she used to perform in the Ike and Tina Review, and she was so high energy, and they would get up there and she would dance in her frilly dresses and, you know, belt and dance at the same time, and it was sort of so full of energy. Then the second half of her life was quite different. It was defined by her divorce from a very abusive husband, Ike Turner.
Yeah, well, I mean, she had so much going. So she comes from nothing. She meets and marries Ike Turner, and the two of them build her brand, Tina Turner, one of the most successful artists in the world. This horrible breakup, this horrible divorce that is marked by one of the, you know, most horrific tales of domestic abuse and domestic violence you can imagine. She wrote about it extensively later in her life about the kind of captivity she was in for so long. But she breaks free from that. And then in the late 80s, she goes on a second tour, a second level of fame.
Oh, redefined her legacy.
That redefined her legacy and probably made her vastly more famous. The Private Dancer era that made her more famous, the Mad Max Thunderdome era, more famous than she'd ever have been before. And I think largely because of what she had gone through before, she was beloved by everybody and she became a megawatt A-list star.
You know, she was so triumphant during the second half of her life when she emerged from that domestic abuse saga in her life and defined her career anew and really came out as this strong, powerful woman. She had the big hair. She was in Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Yeah. I mean, she was omnipresent and she was already in her 40s and 50s that point in time. I think we live in a particular era in our society where people tend to wallow in their victimhood. They sort of retreat from it. Tina Turner defined the way to really rise above sort of the story. She wasn't allowing the narrative to be Ike beat me and therefore I sort of was out of the limelight. She took it and she ran.
And then she marries another man. She moves to Switzerland. She lives a European lifestyle for the waning years of her life. By all accounts, extremely happy in the new life. She overcame a tremendous amount in her life, perhaps more than any other huge star, given how she was brought up and then the ordeals with Ike.
And the greatest set of legs in history. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that Tina Turner was known for those legs.
That's right. Let's move on to Paul Rubens, a complicated figure. Paul Rubens created one of the most iconic and indelible characters of the 1980s, Pee Wee Herman. Everybody knows just what Pee Wee Herman looks like. I dressed up like him for Halloween, an homage to his character.
With my horrific Tina Turner by your side.
That's right. That is actually true. He battled long illness. He died at the age of 69. He was very quiet about his illness, but nevertheless succumbed to the illness at 69 years old. His personal life became very, very public in the early 1990s with an awful incident where he was caught exposing himself in an adult movie theater, arrested. And that threatened to define who he was. And in many ways it has. Look, everybody will always sort of, you know, this whole, like, the Family Feud. You know, the number two answer on the board is what happened in the early 90s in the adult theater.
That's right.
But number one is the creation of Pee Wee Herman. But nevertheless, Paul Rubens suffers this really humiliating event in the early 90s. But he came back and he continued to portray Pee-wee in every medium in which they would have him. And he, I think, by the time that he passed, really had overcome it and had become somebody that we look back on with great fondness.
I think that's right. What's interesting to me about Paul Rubens' death is that Pee-wee Herman defined Paul Rubens for the early part of his career, and he almost couldn't shake that. He would have to come to awards events dressed in that tight gray suit with the slicked hair and so forth. But Paul Rubens is actually an accomplished, you know, thespian in his own right.
Stage actor,
he was also a stage actor, and he was a comedic presence beyond Pee-wee Herman. And I thought that incident allowed him to shatter the facade of I'm only Pee-wee Herman. And it allowed him to sort of take on other roles. I remember in the aftermath of the incident at the movie theater, he went on to star in a movie where he played a superhero and he had his hair longer.
Right.
And it was like, oh, that's Pee Wee Herman as well. And then he became Paul Rubens. He never really shied away from embracing Pee Wee as a huge part of his legacy, but he was no longer singularly defined by that moment. And I don't think it's in the way that he intended for things to happen. I think he probably wishes he weren't caught in a theater, but he was able to.
That's probably true. Yeah.
I think in general, that wasn't a great moment for him, but it did allow him to break free. You know, a lot of celebrities have a hard time when they're famous very young for one specific
thing. For such an iconic character, it's easy to get pigeonholed in that one character.
Yeah. Miley Cyrus with Hannah Montana. She had to do so many backflips to become Hannah Montana.
Under it. Exactly right. Exactly right.
I want to move on to another big death. And this was very early on in our podcasting with Jerry Springer. This was, I believe, our very first special episode of Last Days. And we did it because this you know, he passed away and Jason and I looked at each other and said, well, what do we do now? We're running this podcast where we're doing these retrospectives on all these huge celebrity deaths. And now we have one that happened right now
that we can't ignore,
that we just can't ignore. Right. I mean, Jerry Springer was a towering figure in culture, whether you loved him or hate him. And a lot of people did hate Jerry Springer and what he did to culture. And I don't want to whitewash that. You know, he achieved massive success with his daytime talk show, The Jerry Springer Show. It ran from 1991 to 2018, an incredible long run. There were more than 3,000 episodes of the show, and it was frankly known for fighting on stage between, you know, warring families or people with, you know, political differences. And it was built into the show sort of in a way that hockey builds fighting in, that the people on stage would talk about their differences and they would often start throwing chairs.
He laid bare what we've always known, which is that sort of car wreck television that people can't help but watch. It drives viewership. And he sort of said, yeah, I'm going to make it the most outlandish, the most, you know, absurd level of this kind of car wreck television I can. And people are going to watch it. And they did, to your point, 3,000 episodes. And, you know, it's sort of before that, we knew this. We knew that the Donahue Show and Sally Jesse Raphael and these people who had come along before him or at the same time were doing this same kind of thing, but not talking about it openly, sort of pretending they were doing real news. Jerry Springer came out and said, I'm going to put this on. It's going to be absurd and people are going to watch.
Yeah, you're right. There was a real candor about him because everyone else was saying, oh, they would sort of clutch their pearls when it happened, even though you knew Sally Jesse Raphael loved these moments as well and other talk shows of the time. And what carried Jerry Springer through all this is he was actually a pretty resigned, sort of, you know, level-headed kind of guy. You know, he used to be the mayor of Cincinnati, so he would preside over this circus, but at a remove almost. He would give his final thought about it. He wasn't mocking the people, but he also wasn't sort of loud and obnoxious like a Morton Downey Jr. or other types who were sort of dwelling in those same sort of circles. And I thought it just worked for him. Everyone loved Jerry Springer. There was a reason that when you went to his show, people chanted Jerry, Jerry, because they adored him. They were affectionate towards this ringleader of this circus.
Yet he constantly mocked them.
Yes.
Right? His final thoughts were mocking of the people that would chant it.
And yet they clamored to be on his show and sort of adore Jerry Springer at the same time. And it really was quite a trick to pull off. And to see him pass, it really resonated a lot in our office.
And for better or for worse, he then gave rise to the Geraldo Riveras and the Maury Povich's. And that's kind of, you know, let's bring people on for the most embarrassing moments. Dr. Phil, right? That's a whole Danielle Bregoli kind of thing. Bring people on at their worst moments to really dig deep into the awful side of humanity in many ways.
Yeah.
And I guess celebrate it.
That's what he did. And look, he will remain a controversial figure. You know, in the aftermath of his death, not everyone was laudatory.
Right.
Everyone sort of said he laid culture bare.
And maybe there's a point to that, right?
And there could be a point to that. But nevertheless, it was a big inflection point for our podcast to see how can we cover when the deaths happen in real time? And that's what we did with Jerry Springer.
Let's take a quick ad break and we'll be back after this.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, and Walmart, and even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. So download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. R-A-K-U-T-E-N.
So next on the list is Sinead O'Connor. Sinead O'Connor obviously is most known for two things. Number one, she sang the seminal hit written by Prince, as everybody knows, Nothing Compares to You. The size of this song in 1990, I believe, the incredible popularity of the song, it rocketed to number one. It was an amazing song. It is still, to this day, incredibly listenable. It is a really fantastic song.
Greatest cover song of all time. It's not
all credit goes to Prince. I mean, she got the rights. He was delighted that she sang it because it brought a level of popularity to the song that he hadn't achieved on his own. Probably wouldn't have. Not everybody can have hits all the time. But a phenomenal song. The second thing that she's known for is tearing up the picture of the Pope live on Saturday Night Live while screaming, "Fight the real enemy." And this defined the last 30 plus years of her life.
Yeah, what's interesting about Sinead O'Connor, we talked about Paul Rubens, who had an incident that he was able to spin in his favor to move on from Pee Wee Herman. We talked about Tina Turner, who was the victim of domestic abuse her whole life. What Sinead O'Connor did was lean into who she was.
That's right.
She told the world. This was not something that befell her. It's not something that she regretted later in life. She went on SNL. She was a person of deep and sincere convictions. And she felt very strongly about the issue she cared about. And she did not like the Catholic Church, which, by the way, at the time was extremely controversial. In large part, she's been vindicated in those views.
Vindicated, right. We have the series of movies that come out, the spotlight first and foremost among them. Opening up to the world exactly what the Catholic Church, all the abuses that's what she was talking about in 1990 when she did this.
That's exactly right. And it didn't make her the most likable or easy person to be around. You know, she had some controversial views throughout her lifetime.
Yes.
You know, tearing up a picture of the Pope is provocative, even if you feel that the Catholic Church was guilty of many, many abuses.
It can,
it can really hurt people
and offend them. And she was said that that's too bad. That's part of the price that we pay for calling attention to what's happening.
And she did it throughout her life. I will say one thing about Sinead O'Connor. She had her troubles. She had battled mental illness. She died in a very sort of tragic way where she was discovered unresponsive, possibly a suicide is what the result was, and most likely. You know, she dealt with the death of her son. So she was a person who struggled mightily during her life. And I think she was proud of being defined by that second moment in a way that sort of Tina Turner wasn't going to let Ike define her. Sinead O'Connor was perfectly fine with being defined by her stance.
And just as a final note about her, she became a passionate crusader for human rights around the world. So say what you want about her, but she really was one of the great trumpeters of human rights causes throughout Europe for the last couple decades of her life.
Absolutely. Now I want to talk about someone else who was defined by their work, but in a very, very different way. And that's Jimmy Buffett. Jimmy Buffett passed away this year in September. He died at the age of 76 from Merkel cell cancer. It was a disease he'd been suffering with for a number of years, the last 4 years of his life. And Jimmy Buffett, unlike Sinead O'Connor,
No
controversies. You know, Jimmy Buffett was the patron saint of easy living, drinking margaritas on a beach, wearing sort of Hawaiian shirts and parrot-draped sort of clothing and things of that nature. His fans absolutely adored him. And he stuck with that image throughout his career. He never said, you know what, I'm beyond this. I want to go write poetry. Jimmy Buffett aimed to please his fans, and he marketed himself tremendously. I mean, by the end of his life, I have a very close family friend of ours who lives in a Margaritaville, and it's a retirement home, and you can laugh at it, and people sort of mock these things as, oh, those are a bunch of cheesy people, but they really enjoy it.
Yep.
And if you've sort of spent your whole life working a day job in the sun, you do sort of deserve to be in a tiki hut drinking drinks with straws.
My family and I were in Nashville a couple months ago. The biggest bar on all of Broadway there, the main music strip of Nashville, is Jimmy Buffett's. And there is a line around the block, people waiting to get in. And his popularity, his marketability, his brand is still as big in death as it was in life. He's got the restaurants. He's got all the various chains. He's got places where people live. He's got an entire legion of fans that call themselves parrot heads. And they still do. They're proud parrot heads. And no more sort of likable, lovable star, right?
I found him refreshing. You know, he was above cynicism. He knew exactly who
he
was. And, you know, you can't, it's sort of undeniable. When Cheeseburger in Paradise comes on, it's a happy song. And you're really a sort of miscreant if you can't enjoy the music of Jimmy Buffett. And a lot of people in the wake of his death have been playing his songs. They've started to chart again, as happens in the wake of any big music personality's death. And Jimmy Buffett is a guy who'll be missed for years to come.
Somebody else is going to be missed, also died at the age of 76, and also from cancer, in this case breast cancer, was Suzanne Somers. She created the beloved character Chrissy Snow on Three's Company back in the 1970s. The end of her time on Three's Company was marked by her real displeasure with the fact that her co-star John Ritter was paid so much more than she was. She gave an ultimatum to the producers of the show that she, unless she was going to be paid equal to John Ritter, she didn't want to be part of the show. And so they wrote her off, and she eventually left the show after a few seasons. She, in her fight for gender equality, something that still resonates today. This is obviously somebody that it was a real sort of inspiration to the Frances McDormand and other people who have taken up that mantle in recent years.
And she could have drifted into obscurity. She was already sort of a television legend, right? At that point, she could have said, you know what, I've been on Three's Company. I'll sign a few autographs.
The mailbox money from the residuals from the reruns paid her millions and millions of dollars a year. Instead, she's got a second act, which is The Thighmaster. And talk about something people laugh about that made incredible amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars.
All the way to the bank. I mean, this was a joke on late night television for a decade at least, where her infomercials, where she'd put that little device between her legs, and she knew the joke. I mean, the thing about Suzanne Somers is she knew that by wearing a leotard on television in infomercials and squeezing her thighs together.
Well, not only that, the camera angles were always right up the crotch. She's spreading and squeezing the thighs. She knew exactly what she was doing.
But she was in on the joke.
Yeah, that's
I mean,
right.
Chrissy Snow
that's
knew what was going on. She played a ditz on that show, but she was very wily and perfect comedic timing. And I thought her ability to transform herself from basically a has-been sitcom star of the 70s and have this whole second act. This is really a lot of this episode is about the second acts of people, because life is long. And for a lot of these people, life, has to have a series of acts. And she could have just been the Three's Company, star, but she wasn't. And she wasn't satisfied with that. She went on to do the Thighmaster and countless other sort of charities and things during her life. And she was really a special person. She meant a lot to a lot of people. Harvey was very upset by Suzanne Somers' passing.
She was really well-respected in a lot of different circles. She was also one of the few conservatives in Hollywood. You don't see many people who are outspoken conservatives in Hollywood. She was one of those, unapologetically so. I mean, we see that lack of apology coming from the days when she was on Three's Company and demanded what she felt was rightfully hers, and she was going to be unapologetic about that. Then the Thighmaster, unapologetically sort of brazenly commercial when it came to that. And then
smiled her way through all of it.
Exactly. Exactly right.
And talk about a long life. And I wanted to end the podcast with the longest life of all. We will end with the death of Norman Lear at 101 years old in December of this year. He was one of those guys, kind of like Kirk Douglas, who you thought would just never pass. You know, he was always around. And his passing really marked an end to one of the most extraordinary lives in television history. He basically defined what sitcoms would look like back in the 70s, and they still look that way today. With All in the Family, when that show broke, it really cleaved a boundary line between what was old television and what television would look like. And what I mean by that is, in the 50s and 60s, you had a lot of wholesome shows. You had Leave It to Beaver. You had Dennis the Menace. You had Squeaky Clean Housewives and
that ignored life's realities. Just talked about happy-go-lucky things.
Yeah, they were really sort of aspirational. They were like, this is what the American family should look like in suburbia. Very Eisenhower era sort of views of the world. And when he came in the 70s, he said, you know what? I'm going to build an entire show around an anti-hero, an unlikable bigot like Archie Bunker. And he did it to such tremendous success because he identified with that person. He basically created the anti-hero, as I say, where you were rooting for that guy. And he was hilarious because he was pinned against foils like, Meathead and all the other characters on the show. And it was he basically invented the way television looks. Isn't that right?
No, he did. And then he spins off from All in the Family, the Jeffersons, the first black family that was on network television in a primetime slot, and didn't make them caricatures of what the average white guy thought a black family should be like. They were, he had moved up. He was an insanely successful businessman, successful in a way that Archie Bunker never could have been. Archie Bunker resented George Jefferson for that level of success. And he moved up and he became sort of what every American, regardless of color, every American's dream is to succeed where their parents failed or to better what they accomplished. And Norman Lear created that character as well. And then,
Sanford and Son,
Sanford
good
and Son.
Times
right.
where they were impoverished and they lived in the projects, but they had, sort of hope and optimism nevertheless. And with Sanford and Son, he hilariously gave Red Fox sort of the final act of his career. Red Fox was already a legend by that point in time. And he said, I'm going to build a sitcom around this guy and his interactions with his son. And he basically, his imperial era where he could do no wrong in television. He could launch any show. When he left a show, it was never the same. So, he left All in the Family, and All in the Family was never the same.
So what he does with Sanford and Son is he takes one of the funniest people in the world, who's one of the filthiest comedians of all time, Red Fox, sits him in a room basically with his son and his, cast of characters who would sometimes come in, and just has him riff. But Norman Lear knew exactly what he was doing. He got this insanely talented guy, and he said, I can create a television show surrounding this guy in his one-room junk house. And that's what he did.
He was incredible, and also a man of incredible convictions as well. He started an organization to combat the moral majority in the 80s. So the Christian right was ascendant. He could sense that they were ascendant in Reagan-era politics, and he said, we need an antidote to this. And so he devoted his life to, espousing the views of the left. He was a proud liberal person, and it was a great thing to devote his time to. You know, he had so much money. He could have just rested on his laurels. He collected mailbox money of ungodly amounts. I mean, ungodly these shows were in syndication, and his real, you know, television heyday sort of ended around the 80s. So there's a lot of life left to live. He just died in 2023, and he didn't do it sitting on his hands. He was a constant presence. He was a comedic legend, and he was always willing to sort of lend an ear or lend advice to young aspiring TV writers. And he was just universally adored. So it was a very, very big loss, and we'd be remiss if we didn't point it out at the end of this podcast.
Well, thanks very much, Derek. It's been a great year. Thanks to all of our production staff, Wild and Branson and everybody else who's helped out with this. It's been an incredible year. We launched in March. It's been more successful than we ever could have imagined, right? It takes up more of our time than we ever could have imagined.
Yeah, send in your ideas. We'd love to hear them. We're looking for, you know, episode things to inspire us and talk about in the new year.
We'll see you in the new year.